If you bandwagon, you have no insurance policy. You're basically dependent on the mercies of a powerful, aggressive state.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by John Allen Gay, as we have a conversation with Christopher McCallion, a fellow at Defense Priorities. Christopher is writing a series on grand strategy, providing more accessible literature on the subject for academics, students, and others new to grand strategy questions. Our episode today covers his first two explainers, Shield of the Republic and Balance of Power, both linked in the description. We get a little deeper on some of the theory today, talking a great deal about hegemonic stability theory and alliance politics. This was a great conversation, so let's jump right in with Christopher McCallion. Chris, welcome to Security Dilemma.
Thanks for having me.
As we get started, what is grand strategy? And why is it important for policymakers?
I base my definition of grand strategy on the one that Barry Posen has provided. Different authors often have different definitions of grand strategy. Sometimes they're more or less general or vague. He defines it as a state's theory about how to provide for its own security. And I think that that's important for policymakers because probably the first and most important priority for any policymaker is to help defend the interests of the American people, defend their vital security interests, and maintain the sovereignty of the United States.
Is that what our grand strategy aims at right now?
I would say that our grand strategy goes far beyond those goals. I think that it wouldn't be fair to say that our current grand strategy necessarily endangers our vital security interests, but by prioritizing a whole set of what I would consider secondary or tertiary goals, I think that it exposes the United States to risks that are unnecessary and that it actually undermines the power position that we would want to preserve and the resources that we would want to husband in order to best secure our vital security interests long into the future.
What are the premises of grand strategy right now compared to what you recommend?
I think the premises of grand strategy right now, whether officially stated or not, are basically that the United States, its domestic institutions, even maybe its physical security, can only really be safe in a world where we more or less prevent other great powers from emerging, where we have unchallenged global military primacy. And, you know, depending on who necessarily we're talking about, I think it is also an assumption of the foreign policy elite that our own security, our own domestic institutions depend on essentially a world filled with other states that are kind of like ours. You know, that liberal institutions at home are dependent on the ubiquity of liberal institutions abroad. And this is a topic in itself that we could discuss, but, you know, Lewis Hartz, in his book, The Liberal Tradition in America, once talked about this tendency to feel that liberal societies are always vulnerable to anti-liberal forces and therefore have this drive to get rid of the competition, as it were. And I think that you see that tendency pop up multiple times throughout American history, and that itself is a problem and a self-defeating endeavor.
Going back to the first part of that, you are basically saying America needs to be the top dog in the international system in order for us to have peace. And you're talking there implicitly about hegemonic stability theory. What is that? And what's up with it?
Yeah, it's like Highlander, the idea there can be only one. Hegemonic stability theory started as a theory in international political economy, which was basically about how a given state, whether it be Britain or the United States, could act as an underwriter of the international financial and trade order. That theory was later extrapolated and then transposed onto the domain of international security, especially by people like Robert Gilpin, with the idea that in the same way that in political economy, a hegemon might provide something like what a state provides within its own domain in the realm of public goods or collective goods, that a state Take, for example, the United States in the post-war period would provide the public good of security and stability for other states. So rather than regional balances of power emerging, which entails to some extent some kind of interstate competition, security competition, the United States instead acts as a pacifier in those regions. There's more to hegemonic stability than just that, but I think the general idea is kind of implicit in the name, right? You, in order for collective action problems to be solved, in order to avoid the turbulent vicissitudes of great power politics, you need a hegemon, preferably a benevolent hegemon, to stabilize the system, reduce the competition inherent in anarchy, and provide some kind of international governance, essentially. I think at its extreme, the idea is essentially to remove international politics from a Hobbesian state of nature and impose some kind of Leviathan onto the international system as a whole.
Yeah, and I think back to like the, I think it was the 1992 defense planning guidance that was basically arguing exactly this and saying that the United States, by serving as a global hegemon, can be so much stronger than any potential challenger that they don't even bother trying to challenge us by engaging in like arms buildups and things like that. And that thereby you can have sustained U.S. primacy. And this was very controversial. Like if you read the New York Times article that revealed it, clearly people thought like, wow, this is really a big step for the United States. And yet nowadays, it's kind of the background assumption of Washington policy thought. But also, if you look at how the academy has tried to distill different schools of grand strategy, basically all of them, other than restraint and offshore balancing, run on hegemonic stability theory. I'm not just saying that, you know, this is like, you know, that big Texas National Security Review article. I'm forgetting the authors. We'll put it in the show notes.
Avery et al.
Yes. That made this argument and said they all run on hegemonic stability theory except restraint and offshore balancing. And that to me presents a big problem if hegemonic stability theory is not true, which you've made a case, you pointed out a lot of people have made the case that it's either not true or self-undermining because it's more costly to be a hegemon than to not be a hegemon. So the non-hegemons can make relative gains against the hegemon over time and make it even harder for it to stay hegemonic and maybe even break its hegemony. So one, maybe hegemonic stability theory just doesn't work and therefore all of these major schools of U.S. grand strategy are bunk, or it's also possible that maybe we just can't afford to do hegemony anymore, even if HST works. Like, if it's not possible with the rise of China and with some other unfriendly global trends for the United States to continue being a hegemon, even if we try, then you also can't have an HST-based foreign policy. And I feel like we're only getting the beginnings of a post-hegemonic grand strategy conversation. You know, I think folks like Bridge Colby are beginning to bring in some like quasi-hegemonic or sub-hegemonic perspectives on how the United States can secure itself in the international system. But by and large, it's OB and it's restraint that are offering alternatives. I'm curious what you think about this.
I mean, there's so many things to say about that. One issue with hegemonic stability in the academy is, as you alluded to, it was pointed out quite a while back that there were some problems with the initial literature, some empirical and theoretical problems with the initial political economic literature. And then in more recent years, there have been people like Dan Dresner who have kind of taken on the idea of hegemonic stability in the realm of security. Even, you know, people like Gilpin famously, you know, didn't think that hegemony was perpetual, right? What they were mainly concerned about was hegemonic decline, and then a war breaking out as a result of a power transition. There's another school of thought that's kind of related called power transition theory, the theory of how hegemonic wars break out between people like Gilpin on the one hand and power transition theorists on the other is quite different, right? Who actually initiates a war. You mentioned this 1992 defense planning guidance, which is basically about, you know, suppressing any possibility of a challenger emerging, any other kind of great power emerging. Yeah, I think what's very important about that too is that it also talks about preventing our nominal allies, particularly Germany and Japan, from emerging as independent poles of power. And I think for those of us who are trying to answer the question of why it is that our, you know, in particular NATO, why it is that our commitments to our allies seem not to have changed despite the disappearance of the threat that they were formed to counter, I think we kind of have to start acknowledging that at the same time that our current grand strategy, call it what you will, primacy or liberal hegemony, proponents like to call it deep engagement, while it is on the one hand to, you know, designed to contain great power adversaries, I think we also have to acknowledge that to some extent it's also designed to contain our own allies and to at least discourage them from trying to achieve strategic autonomy or become independent poles of power in their own right. It should be said, and to some extent, you know, this is to give some credit to people who tend to be aligned with hegemonic stability theory. That's only possible because the United States, to some extent, is a relatively benevolent hegemon to the extent that we exercise extra-regional hegemony on the flanks of Eurasia. It has been a pretty good deal for the Europeans, for them to outsource their security to us for the better part of a century. You mentioned a whole number of other things, though, John, and you might have to get me back on track, but we could talk for 2 hours just about that.
Yeah, and I think, again, like we really need to reckon with the possibility that hegemony might not be attainable anymore.
So two things that you had mentioned before, one being, even if we were to take at face value the argument that hegemony is kind of, in the first place, possible or desirable, it is self-undermining, right? In the sense that the hegemon or the patron has to take on all these burdens on behalf of its, in this case, allies, its security dependence, and that drains its own resources. It encourages it to act more aggressively than it would otherwise have to, and that itself promotes counterbalancing. There's also just the basic fact that no state can be powerful enough to, and this is particularly the case in a world of nuclear weapons where states don't have to be particularly powerful to acquire them, and therefore to acquire the ultimate deterrent. It's not really possible to prevent new great powers from emerging. One of the odd features, actually, given everything that we've been talking about with post-Cold War U.S. grand strategy, and a kind of challenge to what I've been saying about it largely being about suppressing the emergence of new great powers, is the relative ease with which we kind of facilitated China's rise to being a great power.
Yeah.
And I think that that's some place where you have to start giving more credence to the kind of liberal hegemony hypothesis that American policymakers were so convinced of the ultimate superiority of liberal values or the idea that economic liberalism will inevitably bring about domestic political liberalism and that inevitably brings about peace, right?
Yeah.
Based on democratic peace theory, the idea that, you know, if China were to liberalize and democratize as a result of its growing economic interdependence with the world, that eliminates the incentive for competition with a state like the United States that can lead to actual kinetic conflict. That's a whole other subject in itself, but I think that those were the assumptions that guided American policymakers when they decided to try to, in their minds, bring China into the liberal international order, kind of bind it to the United States, increase ties of interdependence, and, you know, did so under the belief that that would actually remove the problems that we associate with having other great powers in the world who, in prior eras, would, you know, engage in security competition with a great power such as ourselves. You brought up how restrainers and offshore balancers are really the ones providing an alternative to this kind of view that a hegemon always emerges, that whenever a vacuum emerges, someone will fill it. You noted that even people like Bridge Colby, who are kind of prioritizers, are at least inching towards some kind of a post-hegemonic stability theory kind of view of the world. I think that this is where we have to talk about the assumptions, kind of, to some extent, even like pre-theoretical assumptions that undergird the way that people look at the world. And there have been some people in recent years who have said that states don't always have a grand strategy. Policymakers don't always have a well thought out grand vision for how they're going to conduct security policy. The point is really, though, that these are communities that emerge through certain complex processes of socialization, and they develop a shared worldview, and they have some common assumptions about how the world works. And I think one of the commonly held assumptions that American policymakers and policy planners share is that a single power writes the software on which the rest of the world runs. A challenge to anything is a challenge to everything. And it's not a view which has much room or is comfortable with the idea of there being other powers in the world who are pursuing their own interests that aren't necessarily controlled from Washington, and to trust in the tendency for other states to balance. I think that that is a source of anxiety and discomfort for policymakers in Washington. They don't want there to be other powers in Eurasia in particular who have the capability to defend themselves and therefore follow their own prerogatives, which may align with the United States prerogatives or may not. I think another commonly held assumption that a lot of people in Washington tend to have is that states, maybe second-tier states or other great powers even, tend to bandwagon rather than balance, right? Mm-hmm. And despite the kind of legacy of the Vietnam War and all of us learning in sixth grade or something about the domino theory and how that's a dumb idea, domino theories are very prevalent in mainstream foreign policy discourse. Concern about American credibility is ubiquitous. What is not prevalent at all is the kind of insight that comes from balance of power theory, structural realism, or even classical realism, that in fact, the tendency among states is to balance. When one state is beginning to achieve a preponderance of power, the weaker band together in order to balance it.
Yeah, I love that distinction between balancing and bandwagoning. I'm always pushing people to look at Steve Walt's Origin of Alliances, which deals a lot with this and with kind of a threat-centric model of how states form alliances. And basically, he points out bandwagoning with an aggressor is a really dangerous strategy because you get the opportunity to let the aggressor like help you get chunks of something that you both want, but you're also making the aggressor more powerful and therefore making yourself more vulnerable to the aggressor in the long run. And I mean, a classic example of bandwagoning is like Hungary in World War II aligning with Germany to recover territory that had been taken from it in the Treaty of Trianon. And they end up by the end of the war getting basically cooed by the Nazis because they made Germany super powerful and made it so there was like no security alternative in their neighborhood that they could turn to. And Walt basically says, yeah, like states do bandwagon like that, but it's rare that it's states of consequence, states that can throw their weight around in the international system and therefore affect the international balance of power. And, you know, I think you can make a pretty good case that having Hungary as part of the Axis was not a major asset to the Axis. They marginally contributed.
Yeah. The point isn't necessarily that states never bandwagon. And there are different circumstances that govern when states do. Or some states bandwagon because they have no choice. And that is, generally speaking, weak states, right? They've been deprived of the option of buck passing or balancing or other strategies that states pursue in order to, you know, best preserve their sovereignty. If you bandwagon, you have no insurance policy, right? You're basically dependent on the mercies of a powerful and aggressive state. And it usually doesn't turn out very well. Some states, like you were saying with regard to Hungary, bandwagon for profit, to use Randall Schweller's term. The results are rarely good. There's an important point here about IR theory and structural realism, which is that when you use a theory, it's not meant to explain every empirical instance 100% of the time. You're really talking about generalities and tendencies. And one of the ways that these manifest themselves and influence international political behavior is that the states which survive, the states which are shrewd enough to be able to continue existing, are socialized. They learn best practices. They see which strategies work and which strategies fail, and they emulate the example of others who succeed. And part of the reason why bandwagoning is relatively rare is that it doesn't really succeed very often. The results aren't particularly desirable. You know, if we applied this, say, to East Asia and the discussion about Taiwan and what's at stake with Taiwan, it's commonly said that if the United States does not jump into the fight and help defend Taiwan, that will undermine U.S. security commitments to other states in the region, and they will quickly cut a deal with China as quickly as possible and basically accept its hegemony over the region.
And this is basically Bridge Colby's theory. It's pretty much that it would be us in Japan.
Right, exactly. I don't know if you would exactly say it's a contradiction, but it's interesting from the point of view that somebody like Elbridge Colby has, which is largely based in offensive realism, that states respond to uncertainty as to the intentions of others by trying to maximize their own power. And here we're talking about states that aren't, you know, like Japan is the third largest economy in the world. We're not talking about a state like Hungary in Europe, you know, before World War II. We're talking about a state that has some considerable latent power potential and even some considerable existing power potential. It's very hard to imagine a state like that, especially one which has so many defensive advantages, very hard to imagine it just simply watching Taiwan go down and then deciding to throw up its hands and say, we have no choice, we're going to bandwagon with China. It's not really credible to me, right? In the face of the uncertainty as to, you know, what will China do once you've basically left yourself at the mercy of their own goodwill. To me, it's not particularly credible.
To kind of go the other direction with it, with states that at least appear to be bandwagoning with the United States in security situations, you mention in Shield of the Republic that weaker states are forced to either accommodate stronger states, form alliances against proximate threats, and I'd love to hear more about this last point, find shrewd ways of pitting stronger powers against another to survive. If you're America, and we're talking about U.S. grand strategy, as the strongest power, how does America avoid the strategic threat of being pitted against other powers for the interests of a weaker state?
The first thing that the U.S. could do to avoid that is not make broad overarching commitments to weak third parties in other parts of the world, especially when there are rival great powers that have, you know, pretty observable and strong interests in those same countries, right? I mean, here we're talking about Ukraine, we're talking about Taiwan, to some extent we're talking about Israel. Yeah, I think the best thing that the U.S. could do in that case is, it's almost self-evident, right? It doesn't make sense to make commitments that really strain credibility to states that other great powers see as being vital to their own security interests. Israel doesn't fit that model exactly, but there's a similar dynamic at play where we've made broad and overarching commitments to their security, and that is now putting us at, you know, some risk of getting into a regional war with Iran. It also creates some perverse incentives for the country that we're sponsoring to try to bring us into the fight. Ukraine has made more or less clear that they want NATO in the fight. Israel is acting in a risk-acceptant way, which I think they know makes it more likely that the U.S. is going to get pulled into a fight on their behalf. Same with Taiwan. Despite the alarm over Taiwan's situation, their own military spending is not really going to the types of things that would be the most effective at deterring the mainland from invading. They're going to a lot of aircraft bought from American contractors, which will most likely never leave the ground if China were to actually invade. These are things that put the United States at risk unnecessarily, because very often these aren't vital interests to the U.S. itself. We're making commitments that nonetheless tread on the toes of other great powers and what they see as their vital interests. And we're also encouraging those third parties to act very often in a less responsible or cautious way than they would if they were on their own. This is a phenomenon that Barry Posen has called reckless driving, you know, where we're essentially enabling reckless behavior by states in this case who aren't really treaty allies of the United States either, right? These are kind of security partnerships we have, or, you know, major non-NATO allies in the case of Taiwan. So yeah, I mean, the best thing the United States could do is not to take it upon itself to make those commitments, because, you know, in the case of Ukraine, we're the ones who spearheaded the effort to bring them into NATO. Same with Georgia. We weren't being pulled into it. Some people say, when you talk about post-war NATO expansion, that, well, this wasn't the U.S. This wasn't a U.S. initiative. All the states of Eastern Europe and Central Europe were the ones who were pushing us to expand NATO, which to me is not a very compelling argument for why that happened, just because they are essentially asking the United States to extend its nuclear umbrella to defend them doesn't mean that the U.S. is compelled in any way to do so. And there wasn't much debate in the United States about whether that was wise, whether that was really in the interest. There was a debate, right? There was a debate among experts. There were obviously people like George Kennan and Jack Matlock and all kinds of people who said that we shouldn't do that. In terms of actually making it happen politically, you know, there wasn't much friction in the process.
And the debate faded over time. The more recent rounds of NATO expansion, some of which were quite risky, were less controversial than those first rounds where it was like, hey, you know, I mean, not to keep talking about Hungary, but they were one of those first post-Cold War expansion states. And there was much more debate about them. I'm pretty sure the vote on the Balts, which are highly vulnerable and are not exactly the geopolitical keystone of Europe, I think there were maybe 10 votes against. And I think it was like 30 on the first round of NATO expansion in the Senate. I think, like, in some ways, I liked your point about how some of this was the U.S. driving it. So it wasn't even necessarily entrapment by junior partners. It was like us running into the trap of our own free will, enthusiastically joining them there. One, it's part of primacy. It's part of this view that we benefit from having really extensive security commitments. But two, it's associated with this deeper view of alliances and partnerships as an end rather than a means, like that defending democracies and aligning with pro-Western countries is what our foreign policy ought to be, rather than forming alliances is a tool for securing the United States. We don't exist to serve our allies. Our allies are not identical to us. Their good is not identical to ours, even though it's nice when they align. And that therefore there's been this drift in how we think about our partnerships, and we come to identify with those partnerships rather than seeing them as a kind of give and take relationship, and rather than being sensitive to these dynamics where there's divergences of interest or divergences of risk tolerance.
Yeah. So one of the papers I'm working on in this series on grand strategy is on alliances. And there's a great quote by Richard Nixon, kind of updating the famous quote from Lord Palmerston, where he says that we have commitments, meaning, you know, alliance commitments. We have commitments because we have interests, not the other way around. And I would say that the definition of entanglement, entangling alliances, exactly what the kind of founding fathers warned about, is that alliances can be seen, as you were saying, as being ends in themselves rather than a means to a particular end, right? Countering a particular threat, trying to balance a state which is threatening to become too powerful. There's a tendency in American discourse today to only see alliances as assets, completely overlooking the degree to which alliances can also be liabilities, right? States, generally speaking, historically, have been wary about getting into alliances when it's not necessary because there are trade-offs involved. They provide some benefits, but they can also provide some liabilities, entrapment being one of them. And as my colleague Ben Friedman likes to say, the United States is kind of self-entangling in that regard. Going back to NATO expansion, I mean, it's not only just that the debate waned with time, even when the states that we were committing to defending were even more peripheral, right? Even more distant from anything that could kind of plausibly be called a vital American security interest, something that we would actually credibly be willing to threaten nuclear war over. It's not even that the debate waned, it's that it has become a test for your adherence to, you know, almost like a loyalty test or something, your adherence to American values or whatever, which is one of the more unfortunate developments in our foreign policy discourse in recent years. It makes any kind of responsible debate, if not impossible, just much harder to conduct.
Yeah, if you're skeptical of expanded U.S. security commitments in Eastern Europe, well, hey, you know who else is skeptical of expanded European commitments? Putin.
Yeah.
Are you on the side of Putin? Do you work for Putin? Are you taking money from Putin? Did you just meet with your handler? I mean, that's pretty much the tone of some of this discourse. Patrick, I know you've got questions here. I don't want to hog the mic.
Oh, no, not at all. You talk sort of about a little bit of a culture, what Stephen Walt terms the blob. But you also quote acclaimed painter George W. Bush when you say, we will fight them over there so we don't have to face them in the United States. But you disagree with that description. You know, this idea that we're seeing it a lot now, I think, with Israel-Gaza, where Israel is saying, like, if we don't defeat Hamas in Gaza, then you'll see it in Paris and in Baltimore. What's the issue with that sort of, like, we have to have the fight over there because otherwise it's inherently going to affect us?
You know, generally, it's a good idea to kind of steel man the other side's argument and try to understand what it's based on. I don't know if I can really do that when it comes to that example. Maybe you could talk about the overused and abused Munich analogy and the idea that, you know, if you don't stand up to something here and now, that the threat will only spread or grow in stature. I think in the case of that George W. Bush quote, he was referring to international terrorism, transnational terrorism. And maybe in that case, you could at least make a kind of plausible argument. But the difficulty that encountered was, how do you combat transnational terrorist groups by invading countries and trying to nation build and create liberal democracies, you know, by first, you know, obliterating the state and any governing institutions and whatever. The real point that I would make, though, that I try to make in the paper with regard to that, is it's not that we have to fight threats over there so that we don't have to fight them here, right? It's precisely because we don't have to fight them here that we can go over and fight them over there. Right, because the United States is, in fact, so secure, our survival as a state is not in any kind of existential doubt, in that case, from transnational terrorist groups who were able to, you know, hurt sections of our population and were able to do really terrible things, but they weren't putting our survival as a state at risk. So it's only because we're so secure that we actually have the ability to go halfway around the world and fight wars of choice, which is what the wars of that period, the global war on terror, really were. They were elective in nature. You could take it on a case-by-case basis. In the case of Gaza and the argument that Israel is fighting a war against Hamas kind of on our behalf, that I think pretty obviously is a misunderstanding of what kind of group Hamas is. They're kind of a single issue group, really. They're not a group like Al-Qaeda that is, you know, kind of fighting this transnational struggle against whatever it might be, Western values or American hegemony or something. And similarly, the whole argument that we're supporting Ukraine because they're fighting this war on our behalf to stop Russia, and that if Russia is not stopped in Ukraine, the next stop will be Poland or, you know, whatever, next stop Portugal, that is also not particularly plausible. First of all, it's not plausible just because whatever Russia's intentions might be, they don't have the capacity to do it. They don't have the capacity to continue marching beyond Ukraine into NATO Europe. They don't have the capacity to take on NATO. Furthermore, even if intentions are not entirely transparent, I don't think it's that difficult to discern what Russia's self-understood, perceived interests are in the war in Ukraine. And those are not applicable. Those don't transfer onto the rest of Europe. They're not seeking to conquer for the sake of accumulating greater power, to tip the balance of power in a decisive way in their favor, right? They're fighting a war on their own border for what they perceive as, you know, vital security interests. You can disagree. You can say that that's paranoid on their behalf or that they are overly eager to use force. And that might be true. But I think that there's a lot of good evidence that that is what they see their interest being in the war in Ukraine.
Well, in terms of solving a problem like Russian aggression or even Hamas aggression, working with partners in other places seems to be kind of a pretty key part of liberal internationalism, whatever it is. But you also state that dependence on the United States renders deterrence in those regions less credible and therefore less resilient than if capable allies directly provide for their own defense. Can you expand on that and maybe talk a bit about how we're seeing that today?
Yeah, I think that that is really a function of the fact that no matter how capable we are and no matter how resolute we may try to appear, it's always inherently going to be more credible that a state will seek to defend itself rather than have a patron like the United States risk its own survival by trying to defend it, right? So there's a question here about the interests that are involved and what the stakes are for the United States when it comes to defending third parties, the balance of resolve, if you will, right? And because we're so distant and because we're so powerful and so secure, there's always an underlying question about how resolute we really are in defending third parties. And that actually serves to undermine the credibility of our commitments to them and undermines deterrence. We've offset that quite effectively for quite some time by having a preponderance of capabilities in our favor. As new powers emerge and are more capable of advancing their own interests as they see them in their own region, vis-a-vis states in those regions who we've made security commitments to, and therefore as the balance of capabilities shifts away from us, that inherent asymmetry in the balance of resolve becomes much more important. So if we take the example of Taiwan, the fact that Taiwan is surprisingly casual about its own defense, I think believing that the United States is going to pull its chestnuts out of the fire if it gets into trouble, that puts the United States in a very difficult situation because our prior military primacy in the Western Pacific is now very much in question, right? Chinese anti-access area denial, their own growing capabilities are making it less and less plausible that the United States can easily prevent them from invading Taiwan or succeeding in that invasion. It would obviously open up a very costly war if the United States were to get involved. But if the issue is important enough to China, then they may be willing to take that risk. And if they think that the United States is bluffing, right, that may only increase the possibility that they decide to take that gamble. We try to, in turn, offset that by making shows of resolve here and there and trying to show that we're willing to fight over anything. So we're definitely willing to fight over something like Taiwan, which we've identified as a priority. President Biden has said that we'll defend it, et cetera. You know, all these people saying it's the cork in the bottle. Ultimately, right, you can't bluff your way into convincing Beijing that Taiwan is more important to us than it is to them. Right. And so if the balance of resolve is in their favor, if at least the local balance of force is in their favor, deterrence becomes very fragile. If you have other states in the region, and if we're talking about, you know, defending a given state, that state itself is taking on a large burden for its own defense, then that shifts, right? People are willing to fight to the death for hearth and home. If you pose it to people that way, you can see this in Ukraine. Right? There's no question that the balance of power between Ukraine and Russia favors Russia very decisively. And the longer the war goes on, I think, unfortunately, the more manifest that will become. However, the Ukrainians were able to put up a very impressive fight at the outset, partially due to things like, you know, Russian strategic incompetence, if you will, or, you know, fairly light commitment to the initial invasion, but also because Ukrainians are fighting for their lives, right? And I think that that makes a lot of difference. It doesn't make all the difference. It's an intangible. There's no way to exactly measure which of the two is going to offset the other the most, but it's definitely a major factor in war. Clausewitz, you know, talked about this a long time ago. And so I think when it comes to the durability of deterrence in these regions that we say we care about, you would think that we would want not security dependence, right? But capable, independent partners who have a greater interest in their own security than we possibly could, right? And who also have a lot of, you know, especially when in combination with each other, if they form their own independent security ties, as we would expect in balance of power theory, they also have a lot of capability that they can bring to bear. That will always be a more resilient deterrent, at least given the kind of current balance of power, what we can bring to bear in these regions, right? And here we're largely talking about, to a great extent, about the conventional power of our allies and then the extended deterrence that we provide. We should also be talking, for example, about some of our allies. Again, talking, right? Not necessarily committing to, but some of our allies may do well to acquire their own nuclear deterrent. We've allowed some pretty wacky states to acquire nuclear weapons over the years. A state like Japan, well-managed, technologically advanced, right? If they were to acquire their own nuclear deterrent, it's inherently more credible that they will be willing to actually use it to defend their own security than it is for us to commit to enter a nuclear war on their behalf.
Well, I have one more question, and it's probably a little bit of a different one than most grand strategy conversations have. But you mentioned sustainability and sustainability technology being an advantage that the United States has. And I'd like to talk about the climate crisis and how it could pertain to future U.S. grand strategy. You're talking about adjustments that people have failed to make to the modern day compared to, say, 1992. But I don't want to, you know, have some 20-year-old condemn us in 20 years when we fail to adapt for 2045. When it comes to the climate crisis, if grim predictions prove correct and large portions of the equatorial world are, you know, unlivable and you get huge migration crises or, you know, just generally rising sea levels in general, how might that affect the overall priorities and questions that the United States is facing about its grand strategy?
Well, it'd be very hard for me to make predictions about the effects of even like kind of relatively,
sure,
you know, medium term effects of the climate crisis on U.S. grand strategy. But I think what I would say is that if you remember during like the 2016 presidential election, the candidates were asked what they see as the greatest threat to the United States. And if I remember correctly, I think Hillary Clinton said it was Iran and Russia and, you know, like whole list of other countries. I think Bernie Sanders said it was climate change. And that was kind of laughed at, but that's not an absurd thing to say. In general, when we're talking about American grand strategy, which is, you know, maybe apart from the issue of climate change or is kind of concerned with a much more limited set of threats, we should at least remember to balance our prioritization of those threats with other concerns that we have, right? The reason why I called the first part of the grand strategy series Shield of the Republic, borrowing the phrase from Walter Lippmann, the famous commentator, the phrase appeals to me because it calls up a picture of American foreign policy being a way of defending the way we want to live, defending our policy-making autonomy, our ability to self-govern and determine our own future. And that means having the ability to respond to and deal with and have the attention and the bandwidth among our policymakers for dealing with our domestic problems, which we have plenty of, right? There's all kinds of domestic issues that no matter what side of the political aisle you're on, you certainly want to devote more attention to. And that means devoting less attention to problems abroad if you can. The question is, can we devote less attention to those problems? And I think we can, because very often we're prioritizing issues that I would regard of secondary or tertiary importance rather than issues that are really fundamental to our living standards, our well-being as a society, you know, the fundamentals, education, healthcare, all that kind of stuff. And climate change is one of those issues. It's something that affects all of us and should be an issue where we can actually cooperate with other countries to a great degree. It's not going to be a silver bullet to get rid of competition between states, or, you know, competition may even manifest in the way that we respond to the climate crisis. Another one of these priorities that is thrown by the wayside when we instead devote all of our attention to a whole set of problems that only exist if you're trying to maintain global hegemony rather than actually respond to a limited set of vital American security interests.
Well, that's all the time we have today. This conversation has been largely based on the first two grand strategy explainers from Defense Priorities, Shield of the Republic and The Balance of Power. I hear there's a lot more on the way. Chris, thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thank you.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.